Chapter 3. If it weren't for the classic rock music coming through the massive boombox circa 1986 on the floor of my shop, I would have gone stir crazy. As it turns out, painting took 5 times longer than originally anticipated, and I was still going at it 3 weeks later. I was becoming very accustomed to figuring out the whole how to run a business thing as I went. I figured out how to make a website and how to become incorporated, figuring out that it takes 18 gallons of paint rather than the projected 4 to cover hideous green was another piece of knowledge I picked up along the way. I also figured out that one of the more frustrating aspects of starting a small business was setting up the credit card processor, finding a reputable company out of the millions of scammers, linking it up with a bank account, a cable line, and trying to figure out the complicated rate structures to see which company was offering the best deal. It took a lot of work. I finally signed a contract with a company through a national bank and was thrilled to get my credit card swiping machine in the mail. The dream of owning my own sex-positive feminist sex shop, my own center from which to travel and pack auditoriums and conference centers with my fun, witty, educational sex seminars was getting closer and closer to fruition. I couldn't wait to get that machine and swipe my personal credit card through just for one penny, just so I could see Femini Boutique come up on my statement. I could almost taste it. But there was another setback. Of course there was. A few days after I signed the contract, I received an email from the credit card company. We took a look at your website, and unfortunately, we will not be able to process any cards for Femini Boutique due to the nature of your business, it read. There was that pesky nature of my business again. First, the nature of my business precluded me from renting the storefront I wanted, and now it meant I wouldn't be able to accept credit card payments in my boutique or online. This was a major problem. Who carries cash anymore? What do you mean by the nature of my business? I asked in a follow-up phone call. Well, the man started, we have a policy against servicing businesses in the adult entertainment industry. Adult entertainment? To me, adult entertainment was flashing neon girls, girls, girls signs, lime green lycra thongs, and a DVD collection of titles like Backseat Drivers 4 and Bangin' the Babysitter 26. I don't see how teaching women about power and beauty and sexuality is adult entertainment. I did not like this blanket anti-adult entertainment clause. When I was a kid, I thought sex was so gross and dirty that I had to cover my ears when hearing the word vagina, a part of my own body. My parents were open-minded and spoke candidly about sex during my childhood, and yet I still received the message that sex, my vagina, and all words associated with those things were bad. How did I come to receive and internalize these scripts if not from my parents? Perhaps because as a child, I couldn't tell the difference between exploitative sexuality and pleasurable sexuality, because the person who wouldn't rent the storefront to me and the powers that be in charge of writing up policies at the credit card processors couldn't tell the difference either. Perhaps in our sex-negative country, no one can. What a sad state of affairs that porn and sex are indistinguishable. I felt like I was in a rubber band room being bounced around in a catch-22. Our society is sex-negative. But I was having a hard time setting up a business to fight the sex negativity because of the sex negative social structures that were in place. And to combat those sex negative social structures, I needed a sex positive education business. But I couldn't do that because of the sex negative social structures. And back and forth and back and forth I bounced. The most frustrating part of this setback was not the fact that I was being denied access to something because of sexuality, or even that I was being lumped into the same category as escort services or hardcore porn. My biggest frustration was that although they wouldn't live up to their end of the contract by assessing customer credit cards when swiped and depositing the money into my Femini Boutique bank account, they held me to my end of the contract and required me to continue paying the monthly fee for 2 years for a service they wouldn't let me use. Don't you think that's a little odd? I demanded after many rounds with customer service representatives. If you don't want to do business with me because I sell vibrators, fine. But why do I keep having to pay this monthly service charge? I never got an answer. I chalked it up to one more thing I was learning along the way in the business school of hard knocks. Read a company's policy on adult entertainment before signing the contract with them. With this newest lesson learned, I was getting highly anxious about the one step to getting Feminique up and running that I had continued to avoid, dragging my feet, dreading. That was getting a business permit from the borough of Westchester, Pennsylvania, where my store was located. I'd already spent so much money, invested so much heart. After my dead-end job hunt in the months prior, I knew this business was my last opportunity. What if the borough of Westchester had a provision against adult entertainment too? Bosses, lawyers, George W. Bush, few things make me more uncomfortable than a man in a suit. And I was seriously stressing over how I was going to go about getting a permit to open a sex shop from the suits in the local government of Westchester. When doing the research for my business plan, I had read online horror stories of sex shops and strip clubs, adult bookstores and topless coffee shops, forced to close or denied permits and not allowed to open due to little-known loopholes of questionable legal merit in local zoning codes. I started reading about a woman-owned sex shop in Pittsburgh that in 2005 was shut down 1 week after opening because it did not have a business permit. The owner had paid for the fees for the permit and was given a verbal confirmation that it was in the mail, but town officials apparently decided at the last minute that her boutique selling lingerie, sexy costumes, and bachelorette party supplies should be considered, quote, a sexually oriented business and thus would have to close and reopen, if at all, in the city's industrial zoning district next to the strip clubs and porn shops. It took nearly a year to straighten out the legal mess, and it cost her countless thousands in legal fees, not to mention the rent she was paying for the store and lost business income. Even worse, in 2007, a Lubbock, Texas sex shop was raided by police officers who hauled away hundreds of vibrators. The female clerk who sold a dildo to an undercover cop who asked to see the hidden display was arrested, and at the time it was still unclear whether or not the state would make her register as a sex offender. An adult making a decision to use an instrument to touch their own bodies in their own home, a crime. The person who sells them the instrument to do it, a sex criminal. In the same category as a person who forces scared children to pose naked for pictures and forcibly rapes a woman as she kicks and cries for help. Register as a sex offender? Fucking seriously? The sexual world I was living in frankly terrified the shit out of me. As a woman, as a freedom-loving American, as a sexual being. The Lubbock area newspaper reported that the rationale of the police department for the bust was Chapter 43 of the Texas Penal Code, which prohibits a person from possessing six or more, quote, obscene devices, which is described as a dildo or artificial vagina designed and marketed for as useful primarily for the stimulation of human genital organs. Texans have the right to own six guns, but they do not have the right to own six sex toys. As I felt my mind starting to battle all that was wrong with these news stories, all that was inherently unfair and repressive, my stress about getting a permit to open a sex shop from the suits in Westchester mounted. Could something this preposterous happen to me? Were these just isolated, albeit outrageous, incidences, the results of overzealous police or government officials up for re-election and not the norm, not a true barometer of the lengths that those in authority will go to ease their discomfort about sex? The sex negative structures I was fighting, the property owner who wouldn't rent to me, the credit card processor that wouldn't do business with me, could the fear of sex really go this deep? Could the government really stop me from opening Feminique? I didn't think such an injustice could slap me in the face. No, that just couldn't happen to me. So although I couldn't shake this anxious feeling I had, not quite nervous puke butterflies, but a dull, nagging concern, I knew I needed to stop procrastinating. I left the shop that night with Jimi Hendrix blaring through the static on my radio with the intention of making getting the permit next on my to-do list. I just left the wet roller on the tarp. It would be hard as a brick the next day, but I didn't care. I was sick of painting. Other small business owners in town stopped by from time to time to give me a hand and check up on me. I thought it was sweet, and I took advantage of their kindness to press them for information on my permit-seeking plight. "He's a real dick," one said of Anthony Cicerone, the go-to guy in Westchester for such administrative tasks. "He will destroy you," said another. "If Cicerone wants you out of business, he will find a way to do it. He hates my shop, so he told me I needed $100,000 worth of work done to be up to code," which was complete bullshit. The young man with scraggly facial hair and dirty work pants didn't exactly fit into the upper middle class neighborhood, and I It wasn't shocking that the suits would want him out. I was disturbed by the injustice and scared. Well, that's just fantastic, I started. Sarcasm is one of my strong suits. What the hell am I supposed to do now? I'm going to go out of business before I even start. This is ridiculous. What if this happens to me? I don't have $100,000. Sarcasm may be one of my strong suits, but controlling my emotions, not so much. I was looking for a comforting older brother-like response from my fellow business owners. Instead, I got a, just don't piss him off. Good luck. As a child, my dad tried to teach me, that you get further with honey than vinegar, and I had read in a self-help book somewhere that if you smile on the phone, it resonates in your voice and the listener responds more positively. For some reason, I actually thought this would work for me when I made my first phone call to the borough regarding permits and was thus surprised to be greeted with the bored, indifferent tone typical of bureaucrats in response. "Hello, Mr. Cicerone. My name is Jill McDevitt," I said enthusiastically, smiling all the way. "You, sir, are a difficult man to get a hold of." I kept smiling and paused to wait for a response that didn't come. So I continued. "I was eager to get in touch with you last week, but your assistant said you were in Palm Springs. That must have been an enjoyable trip." More smiles. "It was on business, lady. Give me a break. What can I do for you?" he barked. "Well," I continued, "I'm opening a small business in the borough, and I understand I need a permit to do this, and I wanted to make sure that this wouldn't be a problem, given what kind of business I'll be opening. It's going to be a female sexuality boutique." Another pause. This guy was killing me. "Send me a copy of your business plan and I'll have the solicitor look at it. Good day." He hung up. I didn't even know what a solicitor was until I asked my disgruntled friend and fellow Westchester small business owner and found out it's the attorney that represents a town. A lawyer. Ugh. Put that on the list of things I was learning along the way. I was overdue for a daily report with George. And he called as I was neurotically reading and rereading the edited, I would say censored, but I don't like that word, version of my business plan that I had sent to Anthony Cicerone in Westchester's Borough Hall. I was trying to determine how the solicitor could possibly find my business in any way unworthy of a permit. Was I just being paranoid? The wait was unnerving. "George, how goes it, my friend?" Me. "Oh, it goes. Fear not, it goes." George, that is never a bad thing. Me, you are correct about that. It's amazing how long a dialogue can last without actually saying anything. Me, so how was the job interview? George, tell me what you think of this one. I'm sitting in the office and I'm yakking it up with the secretary, waiting for the head of the math department to come in, and she offers me a pretzel. Me, okay. George, the question is, should I have taken it? Me, is it a hard pretzel or a soft pretzel? George, it's a soft pretzel. She offers me mustard and everything. Me, was it the last one? George, no, there was a whole platter of them. Me, then sure, you could have taken it. Why? Did you? George, I did, but I still think I screwed myself. She offered it once and I said no thanks. Then she offered again and I said no again. Then the math guy comes out of his office and he insists that I take one because otherwise they'll go stale, so I oblige. Me, that's so belligerent to ask three times. Who does that? Like, it's your responsibility if their food goes to waste. Would they not give you a job because you don't eat soft pretzels? How do they know you don't have a food allergy? I was so glad I wasn't doing the interview thing anymore. What a nightmare. George, anyway, did you ever get a hold of that guy? Me, Anthony Cicerone? Yeah, a few days ago. I need to call him back to make sure he got my business plan. I'm going to do that today, actually. George, can you believe we're talking about this? I'm going to be a teacher. You own a business. We're getting so old. Me, I know. After I was finished talking to George, I grabbed some lunch and then put in the phone call to Anthony Cicerone that would allow me to mark the permit off my to-do list and put my anxiety to rest. When I was done, I called every number on my cell phone with the news. George, didn't I just talk to you? Me, I can't open Feminique Boutique. George, why? Me, I called Anthony Cicerone up and asked him if the solicitor, that's the attorney who represents the town, by the way, got a chance to look at my business plan. He was just so nonchalant about it. He said, oh yeah, the solicitor concluded your business plan is against our zoning code for adult entertainment, so you can't open it. You'll be getting a letter regarding this matter via certified mail. Good day. Can you believe that? No, I'm sorry. No, unfortunately, this is the situation. He just said it like he's so used to dashing people's hopes and dreams on a daily basis that he doesn't even care anymore. Isn't this horrible? George, have you looked at the zoning code for adult entertainment in Westchester?
I could always count on George for a sobering, practical response to my emotional outbursts. Me. No.
George. Well, maybe you should get a lawyer to look at it. But that's the government for you. If that's their law, then that's their law. Unfortunately, there's nothing you can do about that, Jill.
I could also always count on George for accepting the status quo, for better or worse, like taking a soft pretzel he didn't want, so not to upset some high school math teacher interviewing him for a job. But not me. I wasn't taking the there's nothing you can do about it approach, and I knew someone who would encourage me not to lie down and take it. I called my dad at work and told him the horrible news. My father is a dynamic, two-sided character who is easier to describe with anecdotes than adjectives. A lover of pop culture, he's a middle-aged white guy who knows all the words to the latest Kanye hit and can also engage in a two-hour debate about moral relativism, metaphysics, or string theory while sitting around the bonfire. People like him. People like him the way they like Ferris Bueller. Whoever he meets tells me, "Your dad is such an amazing person," when he leaves the room. I often thought my definition of success would be people saying that about me when I left a room. Of all his fabulous qualities, he ironically wears a suit to his day job. No one's perfect, I guess. He raised me after his divorce from my mom, and he often found himself in the role of surrogate father to all the neighborhood kids, including Pat, Scarlett, and George. He mended their family fights, attended their little league games and school plays, and was a wise ear to their woes when no one else would listen. He had the take-no-lip parental authority thing going strong, but was never out of touch with the tribulations of youth. He wasn't too good for us. We could even curse around him. I knew early on that the term two peas in a pod was written to describe us. We were always on the same page about life, about what to order for takeout, about anything. And he always had my back, which for the longest time I thought all dads did. It wasn't until later that I realized many don't. "You can be anything you want to be," he would say regularly. "Do what you love and the money will follow. And if you do that, I will be proud of you no matter what." Being the smartass that he raised me to be, I once countered, "Anything? What if I want to grow up to be a prostitute? Would you be proud of me then?" He took a deep breath, indicating an honest contemplation, and then said, "If you did it because it made you happy, not because you didn't have options, if you said, 'Dad, this is my calling, my dream, and you were the best prostitute you could be,' then yes, I would be proud of you." And you can see why I sought him out for straightforward advice during times like these. "Dad," I whined over the phone as soon as he answered, "what should I do? I tried the whole 'you get further with honey than vinegar' thing with the Cicerone guy, but it didn't work. Didn't work for me. I'm not diplomatic like you are." "Well, it's a good skill to learn. But when that fails, you gotta stick it to the man," he said. "Don't let him get you down, Jill. We're all behind you. Not just me, but your mom and Graham and the rest of our family too. You're strong. Much stronger than I am. And you have to fight for what you believe in. It's going to be hard. And you might lose. But you know in your heart what you have to do." He was right. I was going to stick it to the man. That's what I intended to do. I waited with nervous puke butterflies in my stomach for 18 hours for the certified letter that carried my fate as a businesswoman to arrive, and then I put on my suit, the same one I had worn during my rejected job interviews, and marched to Anthony Cicerone's office in Westchester's Borough Hall.